how that all brings me to bugs is when I graduated with that degree in horticulture and started my own landscape company, I became a certified pesticide applicator.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, my extent of knowledge about insects was what to nuke them with to get rid of them when I graduated with that degree. And they were public enemy number one. You have to think of all about the plants and nothing about the ecosystem that right. revolved around them back then. I mean, that was a long time ago. So thankfully, things have changed. Short story is that a woman started working for me who was super into organics, and she started bringing research to work every day, showing me about why I shouldn't be using these products that I am. How can I protect myself? I worked with a guy on a crew whose wife was having all kinds of health issues that were attributed to chemical exposure through her job. And he had a heart to heart with me about that. And it really got my wheels turning. And I decided that 1 year, about 8 years into my business, I decided, you know what? I'm going to convert all these gardens to organic. I'm going to learn everything I can about it.
Nice.
I am a giant science nerd, Greg. I mean, you're going to see that here during our conversation.
Uh-huh.
And I just gobbled up all the research that I could find about how to grow organically. And I made a complete switch for all of the gardens I took care of, my own garden. And over the 15 years that followed that, it became a focus on viewing insects as part of an ecosystem of the gardens, as a way to help us be better gardens, have better gardens and be better gardeners, instead of seeing them as a detriment to our gardens. And it was a huge, long process with lots more details that I'm sure that you're not interested in, mm-hmm. but it was a great step-by-step for me to get to where I am today, which, as on my website right at the top, it claims I am a devoted bug lover, and I truly am. I am just absolutely fascinated by them.
Wow, this kind of goes to our pre-conversation that we had about competition versus collaboration. And I'm a big, big believer in working with our communities, working with the people that are doing this kind of work. And you're collaborating with the bugs as well, it sounds like.
100%. And in many cases, I'm not so much collaborating with them as I am letting them do what they've evolved to do in mm-hmm. the landscape and in natural areas. That's the thing. They've evolved to play a certain role. And when we humans step in and we try to make some impact on them, we throw that whole ecosystem off balance. And right. that's something we can talk about more a little bit later, because it's a really important concept for gardeners to understand when it comes to insect. And it's a complete change of mindset from what we've been taught and we've been told for generations. We've always learned that insects are the enemy. And now so much research is bringing to light such amazing connections between the insect world and the plant world. And we have got to start paying attention.
Yeah. Let's actually dive into that a little bit. Can you tell us what happens when our ecosystems get off balance?
The easiest way to talk about this is by a specific example. And the example that I always like to use when I go out and give my talks and lectures about how to attract beneficial bugs to your garden is that the quintessential thing that all gardeners need to understand is something we all, you know, everybody over 40 probably remembers what a film strip is.
Oh, yes.
And so you used to watch them in seventh grade science class.
Yep.
Probably way back then in a film strip, you learned about something called the predator and prey cycle, which is, as you know, a predator is one animal or one creature that captures and eats another animal, which is called the prey, right? Whether it's the lion and the gazelle on the African savanna or a bass eating a minnow in a stream here in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. it's a predator and prey cycle. And that is a cycle that we gardeners forget about.
Right.
But it's one that exists in our gardens, and it is going on every day, 24/7, right outside of your own back door. But we get panicked about bugs, and we put ourselves in that predator and prey cycle where we do not belong. And so I often use the example of one of the ones most gardeners are familiar with, which is aphids and the ladybugs that eat them,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
The aphid lands on a plant. It starts sucking plant juices, starts making babies, right? Because female aphids can give birth to live clones of themselves. They don't even need a man to have babies, which
oh, wow.
is crazy cool, right? Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
So she starts popping out live clones of herself. And the next thing you know, we have this huge explosion of aphids. And the population of predators, like the ladybugs that eat the aphids, always lags behind
yep.
the population of the aphids.
Right.
And so what do? We panic when we see those aphids. We squish them with our hands. We spray them with the hose. We spray horticultural oil on them, or God forbid, we use orthene or some other nasty chemical. We are putting ourselves in the predator and prey cycle, where we don't belong. And we get rid of that prey right before those natural enemies and those predators were about to show up to help us control them naturally. So it's about giving nature time to do what she has evolved to do, about letting that predator and prey cycle have a place and understanding that it is a natural part of the ecosystem and we have to let it go. We have to give up some of that control and let these good bugs do their thing. The more you do that, the more good bugs you have in your garden and the more pest control you have. And I haven't sprayed anything in my own garden. We've lived here now for 14 years and I've never sprayed anything. No horticulture oil, no squishing things with my fingers, no hand picking, nothing, because I have a great population of good bugs because I've let that predator and prey cycle have its place.
Wow. Mostly I do that here at the Urban Farm.
Mostly.
Well, I'll tell you about that here in a moment. I've been here for 28 years and I've been able to manage everything except the caterpillars. We have the skeletonizer caterpillars that show up on our grapes, and we have the loopers that show up on our cabbage and lettuce and cauliflower and that kind of stuff. What suggestions do you have for the caterpillars?
Okay, well, here's the deal. This is one thing we really have to think about with these insects. If there is no predator and prey cycle in existence for them, then we have to step in. And let's talk about when that would happen. The biggest example is if it's like an exotic pest that was recently introduced to our shores, right? It has not even co-evolved here with other insects that recognize it as prey. So here in the East, we could talk about something like the emerald ash borer, which is wreaking havoc on our ash trees. It's an Asian insect. It has no natural predators here. We could talk about the Japanese beetles. When they first got here for many years, no other insect or bird or rodent or whatever recognized them as a food source. So there was no predator and prey cycle and their population exploded. The grape leaf skeletonizer, I believe, is a native insect. So that's not the case. There is a predator and prey cycle here for it. But there's other things that also influence that predator and prey cycle as well. There are tons of parasitic wasps out there that love to consume or actually love to lay their eggs in many different species of caterpillars. But those beneficial parasitic wasps need to drink nectar from certain types of flowers. If you don't have enough of those types of flowers around, you don't have enough of those predators around to help you manage that caterpillar. It's all super connected. So one of the things that I do in attracting beneficial bugs to your garden is in the back of the book, I actually have a chart that talks about who the particular beneficial insect is, what pests they consume in the garden, and then what you can and should plant in your landscape to promote that particular insect. So for example, in your grape area, if you have just grass between your rows of grapes, you're missing a gigantic opportunity to boost the numbers of natural parasitic wasps. So that would be a perfect place to plant ground cover of crimson clover or any member of the carrot family, from dill to angelica to zizia to parsley and cilantro, and allow them to go to flower. Those are the types of flowers that parasitic wasps need to nectar on because they're really shallow. They've got exposed nectaries. So you're companion planting to lure in a specific beneficial insect that can help you manage that particular pest. There's a great amount of research. Great. I mean, it's huge. And I got to talk and interview a lot of entomologists all across North America about their particular research. And it is just jaw-dropping stuff. And we gardeners can take advantage of that.
Wow. That. So as you were sharing that, I'm over here getting chills. It's like, wow, that's amazing. Because what you've just put in place is a companion planting for beneficial insects that drive the predator-prey process in your own yard.
Absolutely, 100%. And the last half of the book is actually about what specific plants have been researched and have been noted as being really good at supporting particular beneficial insects. I mean, and there's more and more research coming out about that. This book is now a few years old, and I could go in right now and do another revision that included lots of different new research that's come on the market. And to go back to that grape leaf skeletonizer, there's another factor in here, and that is that an alternate host plant for them is the Virginia creeper. And so when Virginia creeper and other host plants that they use are not available, what are they going to turn to? They're going to turn to our cultivated plants that are planted in big long rows. It's like a giant flag out for them. Hey, here's food for you, right? Because we plant things in big long rows. Mm-hmm. When we interplant them with other things and other crops, it's a lot harder for pest insects to hone in on that particular host plant. So maybe plant a couple of native Virginia creeper on the mm-hmm. the margins of that field. Yes, it can potentially increase the numbers of pests because it's providing them another food source. But if you put it far enough away, you can maybe use it as a trap crop. So it's about experimenting, reading what's already out there, and finding ways to make this system work for you.
Wow. I'm just blown away. This is brilliant what you've done here. I want to confirm something. This is the book you've mentioned twice now. It's the book Attracting Beneficial Bugs to the Garden?
Yes. Yep.
Perfect. So what makes a beneficial insect? I often will get emails with photographs from my listeners and they'll say, oh my gosh, there's this bug growing in the backyard. How do I kill it? That's always the first place they go. My first thing for these interactions is, hold on, we got to identify it, find out what it is. So what makes a good beneficial bug?
Yeah, and that actually, Greg, drives me bonkers when people do that. You know, mm-hmm. they'll post a picture of a spider or of some random insect, and the first thing everybody comments is squish it, squish it, squish mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. The truth is that there are just under 1 million insects identified in the world today.
Wow.
Well, scientists estimate there's between 2 and 20 million different insect species. So at best, we haven't even managed to identify half of them. If there's 20 million species, boy, we barely have the tip of the iceberg identified. But what we do know is that of that million or so that we have identified, less than 1% are classified as known agricultural or human pests. So less than 1%. It is a very, very small percentage of insects that you find outside your back door that are harmful to humans in some way, whether it's eating our crops or biting us or, you know, stinging us or whatever. It's a very small percentage. But yet the bad guys, quote unquote, always seem to get all the press, right? They seem to get all the attention, and it's crazy that they do. So what makes a bug beneficial? And that was your question, right? So in gardener's terms, we can look at it as two different categories. The first category would be the pollinators. Obviously, we need bees and butterflies and beetles and flies to pollinate our crops. They're absolutely essential. They've been in the news a lot lately because of population declines in so many of those species. The other group of beneficials would be the predators and the parasitoids. And we talked about what a predator is, which is one animal that catches and eats another. But a parasitoid is one animal, in this case, we're talking about insects, that use another insect as a host for their developing young, primarily as a host for their developing young. Sometimes it's a host for themselves, but it's mostly a host for their developing young. And eventually, with a parasitoid, that host will die. A parasite, the host doesn't die. A parasitoid, the host dies. So when we were talking about the caterpillars that have all those parasitic wasps, they use them, they lay their eggs either on or under the skin of that caterpillar, and then that caterpillar serves as food for the developing larval wasps. So there are literally tens of thousands of these relationships in these insects. Taconid flies are another great, huge group of parasitoids. They look like regular old houseflies out in the garden. But if you ever see what looks like a housefly on a flower, it's not a housefly. It's a taconid fly. In a taconid fly, the females lay their eggs on other insects, and that egg hatches and burrows into the insect and consumes and eventually kills that insect. So it's a huge group, thousands and thousands of different species of taconid flies in North America.
Wow.
Yeah. So predators and parasitoids are that other group of beneficial insects.
Cool. And, you know, I guess we can add those to our gardens as well, just like you can buy ladybugs.
Yeah, you can. And it's an interesting topic for you to bring up. It's not really something that I recommend for outdoor places because there's been a lot of research that shows, you know, insects can't be contained. If you're in a greenhouse and you're releasing them in a controlled setting, it's a different story. But when you're releasing them outdoors in the garden, there's no guarantee that they're going to stick around. They have to have a certain level of resources available to them and a certain balance of resources in that particular site as well. Mm-hmm. If there's not enough nectar for the adults, if there's not enough host insects for them to lay their eggs, if the humidity isn't right, if there's not enough moisture, you know, all these factors come into play that would ensure success with those releases and with biocontrol. But it's not easy to make sure that all of those factors are coupled together in the right way. But actually, it's much more valuable and important for you to nurture the beneficial insects that already exist in your garden rather than importing new ones and sort of taking that risk as to whether or not they're going to work. Uh-huh. So instead, you have to do like certain things and create an environment where the ones that are already living there are going to really flourish and thrive and make this welcome environment for them.
So really what you're doing is you're making a garden for your bugs so that they show up and take care of your plants.
Exactly. It's habitat creation. Mm-hmm. It's a good bug garden. You know, technically it could be called an insectary garden. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that you can do to make that happen. It's not just about planting the right plants, although that's certainly a part of it, but there are other factors involved as well.
Nice. Like what?
Well, I would say probably the biggest number one thing that gardeners can do is quit cleaning up the garden at the end of the season. Mm. Now, I'm not talking about a plant that was, you know, really pest infested. If you had a plant that had a ton of pest damage to it and there's a possibility of those pests overwintering on that plant, then you have to cut that plant down at the end of the growing season and get rid of it, mm-hmm. because obviously it's harboring a pest. But if it was a healthy, disease-free, pest-free plant, especially if it was an insectary plant, that's one that you should leave standing all winter, because these insects need a place to hibernate or enter a state of diapause, which is the insect world's version of hibernation. And so they right. need a place to hunker down for the winter. And when we cut everything down, we rake up all the leaves, we clean everything up and make this pristine environment, we've taken away all of their sheltering spots and we're starting back at ground zero in the spring. When instead what we want to do is delay our cleanup in the spring until the temperatures are regularly in the 50s. By then, the insects, the days are longer, the insects have sort of woken up, and they're starting to go about their business, and you are not harming them. And right out the gate, you're starting with a good population of beneficial insects instead of starting at ground zero.
Perfect. You know, one of the things that I often do here at the urban farm is I let things go to seed, and a lot of the things that I let go to seed are biennials, which means it takes, you know, 18 months. So the plants actually live through what could be two winters. So that's helping things, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting. You are the kind of gardener that likes things to go to seed, but there's certainly gardeners that are worried that if they leave their plants stand through the winter, that they're going to go to seed and become, you know, potentially weedy. And if that's the case, if, you know, one of your listeners is that person, all they need to do is cut the spent flowers off at the end of the season. You know, if you love goldenrod, which is a great plant for beneficial insects, but you don't want it to go to seed, mm-hmm. just cut the flower stalks off after they're done blooming. It's really that simple, you know, so it's being smart in the garden, yeah. making choices that benefit somebody other than you. Right.
Right.
Start gardening for somebody other than you.